this is Saturday Night Live's Day of Sobriety number 20, and this is our noon meeting. Our speaker this afternoon will be Kenny F. from Spring Valley. The original recording and its copy are at the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes, and please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kenny. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Cajon View Open Discussion in Spring Valley, California. That's out in San Diego. Best damn group in AA, as far as I'm concerned. It's an honor to be here today. I'll share a little bit of what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. First of all, Victor, he's my best friend. We got sober together up in Anchorage. And that's kind of why I'm here today. But a long time before that, I was born and raised in Montana. And I grew up in a small town up there of maybe 100-150 people. And, the most exciting to do in town was to drink. There was two bars and one store and two gas stations, and that was about it. Had a lot of drunks. I grew up there, I can remember the very first time I'd ever taken a drink of alcohol. It was my oldest brother was talking on the phone and he was chasing these girls, and he was about a senior in high school or something like that, I guess. And a buddy of him were talking on the telephone and, chasing these girls, and they were drinking this vodka. This kid that was with my brother, his mom and dad owned a distillery up there, and it was legal too, they were drinking this vodka, and and I was watching them. I was in about the third grade or somewhere in that area, and I can remember that they'd take a drink off of this vodka, and they'd talk on the phone a little bit, and they'd take a drink off of this vodka and talk on the phone a little bit. And every time they took a pull off of this bottle, then they got a little more courageous on the telephone. And I seen something was happening there, and I thought, whatever was happening to them was coming out of that bottle. And so when they'd take a drink out of this bottle and talk on the telephone, I'd take a drink out of the bottle. I probably drank about a third of a fifth of vodka. That very first time I ever got drunk, I got all the classic symptoms from it. I blacked out and I threw up all over the place and I fell down and didn't remember what I'd done and got the hang of it. Very first time I ever got drunk, I got hungover the next day. But you know something, in that small time, in between the explosion, when it hits our stomach and we get that warm, fuzzy feeling and the blackout, I enjoyed what was happening to me, and it seemed to laugh a little easier, and it seemed to be able to talk a little easier, and it seemed to understand a little easier, and I pursued that illusion until I was 27 years old, that was the very first experience I'd ever had with alcohol, and I enjoyed it. And then a number of years went by, and I didn't drink, and I didn't do none of that stuff, and I got real involved in school, and I had good grades. I always had good grades up until the time of high school, and I was always real athletic and stuff. And I can remember from about that time until junior high, I don't think I'd even drank again, but I remembered that very first time. And when I got into junior high, I moved to a little bigger town, and it was late 60s, early 70s, somewhere in that area. And it was right at the scene when free love was coming out, and the hippies were doing their gig, and there was a lot of drugs coming out of the scene and stuff. And, I was raised in Montana. There wasn't much said about drugs up there, but I can remember I was doing this class in school, and there was a current affairs saying, and one of the things that we were told to do was to do research on these drugs and stuff. These drugs and stuff that were out on the streets, and at the time there was like mescaline and mushrooms and pot, and LSD and stuff like that, and some of the effects that they had on people and stuff, and I was infatuated with it. And I was like, I gotta try some of this stuff. And so what I did is I fed into the group that did this stuff, and it was completely out of my element. They didn't do sports, and they weren't very curricular active, and they were wild, I'd always had a little bit of that streak in me. My dad drank real heavy all of my life, and he was real wild, and then I fell in with this crowd, and you know, I never did do any drugs with them or anything, but you know something, I got educated to what it would do to me, and finally the opportunity came along. It was that my oldest brother had gone to Vietnam, the same one that was talking on the telephone when I was in the third grade. He had come back from Vietnam, and he had bring some opium with him, you know, and he asked me and my other brother if he wanted to get higher, and my brother said no, and I said yeah, you know. And the very first time that I'd ever done drugs, I OD'd, you know. As I did that shit, and I loved it, you know, and it took me out, and I remembered, you know, before I OD'd, you know, I enjoyed the feeling that happened, and then, you know, he went back to Germany or something like that, and so a long period of one time, and then I'd gotten into high school. And, you know, in all this time, you know, I grew up with cowboys, and I grew up with loggers, and I grew up with construction hands, and, you know, all these guys were this tough image, you know, and if you weren't tough, and if you took any shit, then you got whopped on, you know, and you never made it. I mean, you got the leftovers of what everybody else had. And so, you know, from the time I was a real small boy, this stuff was instilled in me, and, that's probably why I was such good at sports, is that I was afraid of losing, you know. And by the time I was in high school, I had taken state and wrestling twice, and I was real small. I never broke 5 foot until I was a sophomore in high school. But the thing is that drive to not lose, you know, I was willing to do anything for it, and the drive to be noticed was even greater, and so I would do anything for that. And so I was real crazy by the time I'd gotten into high school, and by that time, you know, we had started knocking off these bars and stuff and stealing alcohol from them. And I can remember it was one of the amends that I owed. It was that this one guy's a good friend of my dad's, and he owned this bar, and it was one of these two bars in this town that I grew up in. And you know, something, every weekend we'd hit this place, and you know, I'm in 7th, 8th grade at this time, and you know, we were stealing cases of beers and gallons of any kind of alcohol. We'd steal everything we could pack. You know, there was 5 or 6 of us that were doing it, and we'd make 3 or 4 trips in a night. And you know something? By the time Monday rolled around, all that alcohol was gone, and we were young kids doing this, and you know, we were putting stuff away. And something else too. If I cuss, I want to make an amends for it now, because I cuss a lot. And I heard Perry say, you know, cussing this man is really difficult for me to do something that I'm supposed to not do. But anyway, you know, we had done this stuff, and I enjoyed the alcohol, and I got all the results. You know, I'll bet you every single time that I've ever drank, I blacked out. I drank that much alcohol every time. You know, I never drank to be sociable. I drank for the effect of alcohol. And I enjoyed the results that I got. You know, a lot of times when I'd get in an ass-kicking contest with somebody, I'd not lose. But, you know, I never remembered it. I always felt it the next day, but I didn't remember it. And when I won, it didn't make no difference either, because I really didn't care. But you know something, that started my road down, you know, and that was, and it was fast. I can remember, you know, in high school I had done that thing and started drinking real heavy, and then by that time I had started doing a little bit of drugs and stuff, and my grades went from B's to F. You know, in 1 year they dropped that bad, and I quit doing sports. You know, I had an opportunity to go to state and wrestling when I was a junior, and this kid that was the main, you know, kid of the whole time. It was a real cliquish type of stuff, and this kid was their main kid, you know. And by this time, I had grown long hair, and you know, that was a no-no where I grew up. My dad disowned me because of it, and I went out for wrestling, and you know, this is the type of attitude that I'd had by this time. Was that when I went for wrestling, I wrestled for about 3 or 4 weeks, long enough to get the opportunity to wrestle this kid that had taken the state championship 2 or 3 times before that, and it was this town's main boy, you know, and I was really vindictive, and I just went out long enough until I got an opportunity to wrestle him, and I wrestled him, and I smoked him, and I quit right there. Said, you know something, you guys ain't good enough for me, and I walked off the mat and never went back. And you know, that was the last time I participated in any sports in high school. I was real good at basketball. I didn't play football because I was too little. But I did, you know, swimming, you know, I was really good in swimming and all that stuff. And you know, something the alcohol took from me. It just completely took from me. But from that time on, I never participated in hardly any sports. One thing that I used to do a lot was I'd ski loaded, you know. And I can remember the guys that I hung out with, we'd get up about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and and started drinking and doing drugs. And by the time that we got to the ski slopes in the morning, which is 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, we were all ripped. And I did that every day, all day, all through high school. And then I fell in love for the first time, you know, and I fell in love with this guy, and I was dating her and stuff, and I'd just gotten out of high school, and I'd gotten the best job that I've had to date. You know, I was 18 years old. I worked construction for a living. I run heavy equipment, and I landed this job, and they gave me a $200,000 cat, and they gave me, you know, a $100,000 truck, and a company pickup, and a floating expense account across the whole state of Montana, and I could stay anywhere and do anything that I wanted. And you know something, my employer was so lenient and so liberal with this that he allowed us to drink on the job. You know, he said, you guys can drink on the job, because we worked many hours. We'd work all day, every day. And he said, you guys can drink on the job just as long as you don't go too far with them. So you know something, I was in hog heaven where I was at. I was knocking down some good money, you know. My head was this big because I was doing these things, and I was my own boss, and alcohol took that from me. You know something, I'd worked for that guy for about 2 years, and the alcoholism was escalating in me really bad. I'd drink every night after work, and then during the days I'd get drunk. And finally I'd gotten this guy that was a running buddy of mine hired on with me, and we had gone to work one morning, and I think by about 8 or 9 o'clock we'd polished off 2 cases of beer between the two of us. And this was just getting started in the morning, you know something. We were doing some real strange stuff, you know. I was abusing these rigs that these people had trusted us with, and endangering our lives. And something I did is I'd taken the shotgun shell out of my pocket and I threw it at this guy, and I went down inside the linkage on this cat and jammed it up. And you know something, we're 100 miles from the shop. And what I did is I got on the radio and I called my boss and I told him, I said, your cat's broke, come up here and get it, I'll be at the bar. And you know something, they went all the way up there and got that rig and took it down there and tore the whole damn thing apart, you know. And when I walked into the office the next morning, he says, you know, Kenny, he says, we couldn't find nothing wrong with the dozer. And I says, well, there's something wrong with it, you know, it wouldn't go in the gear. And he says, well, we found this stuck in the linkage. And I says, you blaming me for that? And he says, no. He says, I was just wondering how the shotgun shell got stuck in the linkage down there. And I says, well, you know something, if this is all you think of me, then you can take your job and shut it. So that was the kind of personality, that's the kind of personality I still have, you know. And we have to die hard. But you know something, I walked away from that job, and right after that I went and called my girlfriend, this guy that I'd fallen in love with, and I told her what to do with it, you know. And about 2 or 3 days later, I just bought a $150 Afghan dog, you know. And about 2 or 3 days later, I got all jumped up, and I left him sitting out in this field, you know, and he was about the color of this floor, and the field was about the color of this floor, and I went out there to pick him up, and I ran over the son of a bitch, you know. So it was a classic thing, you know. I lost my job, I lost my girlfriend, and ran over my dog all in the same day. And you know, if that isn't bad enough, what I did next is I went out and joined the United States Navy. And you know something, them boys, they know what they're doing when they're doing their job, is that they kept me drunk from the time that I walked into their office till the time that I got off the plane in San Diego to go to boot camp. And I can remember, you know, I was just starting to come down a little bit by the time I had hit in San Diego, and I got off the airplane and I said, you know something, I have made a big mistake here. And you know, so I haven't got a chance if I go into a situation like that. You know, and I did. I went into the Navy and spent 9 weeks clean and sober, you know, in boot camp. So I excelled. And they wouldn't give me what I wanted, you know. And that's the way my personality is. It was something that I found out about myself in the fourth step, is that I couldn't accept people the way they were. And I didn't realize they were doing the best they could with what they had. That's the two biggest defects of character that had riddled my life. And they wouldn't give me what I wanted, so what I did is I rebelled against it, like I had everything else in my life. And by the time that I'd gotten out of sea school, what I did is I had gone into the reserves, and they wanted me to go active duty, and I told them, no way. I says, if this is where they run the show, I don't want no part of it. So I went back home and started drilling with my unit in Montana. And then right after that, you know, I'd always had this infatuation with Alaska. And my dad had worked up there on the pipeline when they were putting the Trans-Alaska pipeline in up there. And then 1981, he flew me up there. And at the time, the bars were still open up there until about 5 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And then they'd close for an hour and reopen. And it was just the beginning of summer, so it was daylight all the time. So when I had gotten up there, the first indoctrination I'd got of Alaska is I went to this cowboy bar up there about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I stayed in there until they threw me out at 5 o'clock the next morning, you know, and it was nice, you know. And when I came outside, the biggest shock that I'd gotten was the sun was still up, you know, and I thought, you know, something's sunny here. I says, I'm not done yet. So what I did was I waited the hour, and I went back in. And that's the way I drank in Alaska. You know, my alcoholism excelled tremendously. And another thing is that pot is legal up there, so you can smoke dope up there legally. So if any of you guys are still smoking pot, that's where you can go do it legally. But what I did is I started hanging out with some iron workers up there, and if nobody's ever been around construction trades, they're a real crazy bunch, and that's who I started hanging out with. And I was getting into a lot of fights, and I was getting a lot of physical damage done to me, and I was lonely a lot. I can remember I was lonely a lot because I didn't know nobody, and I was so rebellious, you know, I just didn't care about nobody or nothing by this time of my life. And I was hanging out with these people and got a phone call one day that this brother that I had told you that introduced me to alcohol and drugs had gotten a plane wreck and killed himself. And so I flew back to Montana, and I had about $4,000 or $5,000 on me at the time. And by the time, in a 3 or 4 month span there, I had drank up all that money. You know, I had drank it all up, and I'd met another guy. I had fallen in love one more time. And you know, and this is how I know I should be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, is how I fell in love with this girl is I had seen a picture of her. I had never even met her before. And so I went and I met this gal, and you know something? I'd already made it up in my mind that I'd fallen in love, so what I did is I pursued this girl. And you know something? This is here, is right at the last of my drinking. And what it was is how I drank at this stage of my life is I never drank six packs no more. I never drank fists no more. Is what we would do, me and this buddy of mine. We'd go up to the high school and we'd panhandle money. And I didn't even need it. You know, I had money in my pocket, but we'd do this. We'd go up to this high school and panhandle money. We'd go out and buy a 16-gallon keg, throw it in the back of my truck, run hose through the window, and that's how I drank. And the last part of my drinking, you know, was I bought it by the cake, and that was barely enough. It was barely enough. You know, these people always expected their share when they got out of school, and it was damn near gone when they got there. But, you know, I was real sick at that time of my life. I was suffering from malnutrition, never knew it. I was suffering from jaundice, never knew it. I was maybe 130 pounds. I couldn't tell you the last time I'd eaten. I couldn't tell you the last time I had gotten a good night's sleep. I couldn't tell you what I had done the day before. My vocabulary was shot. It was done. There was nothing. It consisted of, you know, that F word, and, you know, and that's what my vocabulary consisted of. And every day when I'd wake up, I'd have to drive up to my friend's house to find out what we had done the day before. And, you know, sometimes I was driving down the street one day, and I thought, you know, sometimes I am sick and tired of this stuff. And this was in 1981, just prior to going, or late 81, just prior to going back to Alaska. And I went over to this girl's house, and I asked her to go back to Alaska with me, and I told her, I said, you know something, Laura? I said, you know something, I know we won't make it 30 days in Alaska if I don't quit drinking. And I said, I'll make you a bargain. I said, you know, I'll quit drinking if you quit drinking. And she was up for it because she never knew what I was going to do when I was loaded anyway, so she was stoked about that. And so I went back to Alaska and I told my friends up there, I said, I'll drink with you one more time when I'm done. And it was the same old story, yeah, Kenny, yeah, we know, you know. And I told them, I said, I fall in love and I'm going to do this thing. And so what I did is I drank with them one more time and I quit. About 2 months later, I had this gal come up to, what time do I go to? Okay.
You've been a long time, man.
Those
are real drunk stories.
No way. You know, the reason why I don't do that is that this gal, I'll change it for a little minute here, is that after I'd come down here to California, I'd met this gal in Fresno, and I was kind of dating her a little bit. And I went up there to visit her, and one afternoon we were sitting out in front of this mall, and she says, "Kenny," she says, "tell me your story." And you know something, I love talking about me. This is something that I do real well. And I says, "Well, sure." I says, "You know, I can tell you all of it, or I can tell you bits and parts of it." And she says, "No, tell me all of it." And so, you know something, I sat there for about 2 or 3 hours that afternoon and told this girl my whole story, and the next day she wanted absolutely nothing to do with me. This girl was fighting to the bone. Because I've done some wild stuff. I love doing inventories with new guys now because I get to say the things that I have done to them. You know, we think we're bad people, you know, and we think we have done some really lousy things. And the thing about the human race is that there's somebody who's always done something worse and something lousier. You know, it is the way it is. And if you're a member of this fellowship, and especially the two newcomers, you know something, guilt will kill you. It'll kill you. And shame will kill you. And the only way to get free of that is to do the things that we do. And I can remember when I shared these things with this girl, I felt bad about that. And I made a vow, never again will I tell another female my whole story. As a matter of fact, I tell very few men my whole story. But if you know something, I'm not ashamed of it. It is me, you know, and it is what it took for me to get to be a member of AA. And I'll be forever grateful for that. I can remember this gal said something in Jackson Hole, Wyoming one time. She says, "I am so grateful for every pile of shit that I drug myself through just so I can be here with you guys." And that is what I am grateful for, is the stuff that I've done to where I can be here with you. But anyway, where was I? I was in Anchorage. Was I in Anchorage? I was somewhere anyway. I had gone back to Anchorage and I had stopped drinking. And this guy had flown up there, and from the period between 1981 and 1986 was the craziest years of my life. And I'm going to tell you, you know, I quit drinking. But the thing was, is that I didn't know that I was suffering from alcoholism at the time. I had never met nobody in AA. I'd never even heard of anything about it. And the untreated alcoholism that was going off in my life was crazy. I mean, it was crazy. This girl tried to commit suicide one time because it was so crazy in our household. I had a youngest brother that was trying to drive over here today to spend the day with us, and he was going to come from Fallon, Nevada, and he just couldn't, you know, and this was all right. But I'll talk a little bit about him, too, is that he was living with us at the time, and the rage in me was, it was unbelievable. It was just, you know, it scares me today to think that I can still get that angry. And the rage was bad, and you know, and I'm not going to tell you I was completely abstinent at the time, because I wasn't, and I couldn't be. I'd go 5 or 6 months, and the rage would be so bad I'd drink. And by this time, my tolerance level was shot. I'd drink 2 beers, and I'd be ripped. You know, back to the blackouts, and back to the throwing up, and back to the falling down. And you know something, I knew there was something real wrong with my life, is that, you know, I had always been lonely, and I had always been afraid, and I had always been angry. And I didn't know why, and I knew it wasn't the way it was supposed to be. And I was born and raised Roman Catholic, and they told me that life wasn't that way. And my life was that way, and so I had an idea that it had something to do with God. And I can remember something that happened to me when I was in 7th grade. It was right about the time in school when they were teaching us about evolution. And so me and this friend of mine, we were arguing about God. And I took the side of evolution and he took the side of God. And we argued about this thing all day long. And it was late afternoon, and we were riding on these pedal bicycles. And we were out in front of my house, and we were still arguing about this thing. And you know, this big old black cloud rolled over the top of us, and we were arguing about this thing, and I had a brother that was down there and about 3 or 4 other friends, and this lightning bolt comes out of this cloud and hits this telephone pole right behind me. And evidently there was a branch off of the lightning or whatever come off of that, and it hit this bike that I was sitting on. And this sucker knocked me for a loop, you know? And from that day on, I always believed in God, you know? I never doubted it for a minute. But you know that song, Amazing Grace, where it says, you know, you saved a wretch like me? That's what I felt like. I felt like a wretch, and I felt like I was going to hell because I never had a chance, because I was thinking these things before I'd ever done them. And so I didn't believe that God would do anything for me. And so what I did is, the last 2 years of this untreated alcoholism, you know, this dry drunkenness, I'd gone back to the Catholic Church. And that was worse than just the not drinking. And it wasn't because of what they were doing or what they were saying. It was what they were saying was making me more and more aware of the guilt within me, and the shame within me, and the loneliness within me. And what happened, it was just getting worse. And you know something, I'm not a suicidal type of person. I'd just soon take someone else's life rather than my own. And that's the point that I was getting. I was going to hurt somebody bad. I was always accustomed to hurting people. You know, that's the way I'd grown up. And I was trying the Catholic Church, and I just found it wasn't working, and it was real nuts. And you know, this girl and my youngest brother, they walked on pins and needles around me all the time. They just, you know, I could see them both aging, you know, before my eyes, and they were young people at the time. And what happened is, one day this girl came home from work, and she said, "Kenny, you know, if we don't do something about the problems in our life, I'm leaving." And you know something, I love this girl more than anything that I've, you know, I love this girl still to this day more than anything that I've ever loved in my whole life. And I told her to leave. I said, "Adios." And you know something, when she walked out that door, I knew that I had finally exhausted every avenue that I'd ever taken in my life. I was bankrupt. And I had absolutely no idea what to do. No idea what to do. Except get loaded. So that's what I did, is I spent the next 3 days totally ripped. I couldn't even get out of bed, I was so loaded. When I woke up on the third day, or right around the third or fourth day, whatever that drunk was, and I thought, you know something, I need to get help, and I don't know where to start, so I'm going to pick up the phone book, and I'll start in the A's. And that's what I did, is I picked up the telephone book, and I started the day, and I started going through, and I come across Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called him up on the telephone, and he'd asked me when the last time I'd gotten loaded, and I told him maybe 15 minutes ago, and he says, "Well, that's no problem." He says, "There's a noon meeting. I'll have somebody over there to pick you up and take you to a meeting." And I had no idea what this guy was talking about, you know. And I thought, you know, these people just, they meet to get loaded, you know. That's what I thought. I thought, how's this going to help me? I can do this at home. And I can remember this kid showed up at the door, and he was a newcomer. He was about 90 days, you know, 60 days, somewhere in there. And he's still rocking and rolling himself. And he says, "I don't know much about this stuff." He says, "But if we go to one of these meetings, everything will be all right for you." He says, "That's what happened to me." He says, "If you go, it'll be all right for you." So he took me to an NA meeting instead of an AA meeting. And if there's anybody in here that's members of Narcotics Anonymous, you know, please don't take offense to what I'm going to say, because it's my story. And he took me to an NA meeting, and I stayed there for about 2 or 3 months, and I stopped, you know, I stopped smoking dope. Oh, the whole time I was still smoking dope, you know, and what happened is, I'd hear him sharing meetings and stuff, and they talked about the big book, and my ego, you know, wouldn't, you know, to ask for help was difficult. It was the hardest thing that I'd ever done in my life, was to ask for help. And they'd talk about the big book and stuff, and they'd say, "Read pages 83 through 89, you know, and I'd go to the NA book, and I'd read pages 83 through 89, and this shit had absolutely nothing to do with life and the problems that I was experiencing. And I was suffering bad, and I'd go to meetings, and I was whacked. I was whacked, and it was getting worse. You know something, that point in my life was worse than going back to church, which was worse than the dry drunkenness. And I thought, you know something, I'm not going to make it. You know, I'm not going to make it. I'm going to die out here someplace real soon. And there was nobody in my life to turn to. The only place that I had to come was to these meetings. My family had disowned me. I couldn't work no more. I was about 130 pounds. You know, I was just wasted. I had a beard down to my belly button. And so what I did is, I had taken off and I had gone home, and I thought, you know something, I had a problem with alcohol a long time ago. Maybe I'll try out one of these AA meetings. And so what I had done is, I'd gone to an AA meeting, and it was on a Mother's Day. when I've gone to this AA meeting and people have talked and I'd sat there and then these two guys shared. One guy turned out to be my sponsor and then another guy that was, I think, maybe one of his sponsors. Or he was just one of his friends. Another guy was his sponsor. And these two guys shared, and what they shared about was a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the results that they were getting in their life as a result of taking the steps out of this book. And you know something, from that moment I was totally impressed. It was the most impressed I've ever been in my whole life because I could see the results that these guys were getting in their life from doing what they were talking about was coming out of this book. And I went up to this guy and I said, you know something, I enjoyed what you shared here today with me. I said, will you talk to me a little bit about that? And I'll never forget the look on his face. You know, this boy lit up like a Roman candle. And he knew I was new, and he knew that I was willing to listen to what he had to say. And it was the highlight of his life, and I could see it within him. I mean, he was stoked about getting me. And he says, Kenny, he says, well, he says, yeah. He says, let's do it. And we went to this, and this is where I met Victor, too. And we went in the bathroom, and there's a lot of clothing. It's a shithole, you know. And I love the place. You know, it made me feel like home. I loved skanky bars, you know, and I loved this place. And he took me in this back room, and he had gotten this other guy that was sitting next to him in a chair, and he got another guy named Cecil. As a matter of fact, Cecil just followed him in there. He never even asked him to come in there, but they knew I was new, and they knew what to do. And these guys took me in the back room, and there's an auto club, and they 12-stepped me that afternoon. And what they did to me is I'd ask them a question, or they'd ask me a question, and they'd find the solution for that question in the book. And I was impressed, man. Every question that I asked them, guys, they found something that I could do about it in the big book. And you know something? That afternoon, they took me up, and they took me down, and they took me up, and they took me down all afternoon. And you know, I didn't realize what they were doing, but what they were doing was smashing my ego. And it worked. You know, it worked. And they were like kids in a candy store. I remember this, you know. I remember that it was a highlight of their day or their life that get their hands on me. And they were all different characters, you know. Cecil was real belligerent. Dave was real soft-spoken. And I can't even remember what he got his name. And that he was real knowledgeable, you know. He knew a lot about the book. All three of them knew a lot about the book, but it was impressive. And you know something? When I walked out of that back room that afternoon, I felt like I had just done some drugs or I had just drank. I was that loaded on life. Like my equilibrium was shot. You know, I couldn't walk straight. I couldn't think straight. And I enjoyed the feeling that I had. And what they told me is, they said, you know, Kenny, he says, we can help you never to drink again. He says, I'll make you a promise right here and right now. He says, I will guarantee you that if you do exactly what this book says, the way it is outlined in this book, I will guarantee you will never drink again. That's the promise that he made me that afternoon. He says, but there's one thing. He says, if you change in any way you think it ought to be done, deal's off. He says, but if you follow it specifically, you'll never drink again, even if you want to. And so what they did, this was on a Mother's Day, and I think it had come up on a Sunday. And he says, you got a big book? I said, no. He says, okay, get one today. And I said, okay, I'll buy one. And he told me to buy a big book. So, and he says, what I want you to do is read the first 164 pages of this book. And he says, I don't want you to take no more than a week. He says, I'll give you a week to read it. And he says, then come back and we'll take some steps. And so what I did is I got home, and he told me to buy a dictionary, too. He says, if you don't look... Oops, excuse me. If you don't know the meaning of some of the words that you run across in there, look them up. Because you can blow the meaning of a sentence. If you can blow the meaning of a sentence, you can blow the meaning of a paragraph. And if you can blow the meaning of a paragraph, you blow the meaning of a page. And if you don't get the page, you might blow your sobriety. So you buy a dictionary and look up the words you don't know the meaning of. And, you know, this here is the part of my story where I'm going to sound a lot like Victor. For the simple fact that the same people that 12-stepped in are the same people that 12-stepped me. And what you do in your first year of sobriety is going to dictate what the rest of your sobriety is going to be like. You know? It says it a little something like that right after the promises, but that's, you know, what you put into it is what you're going to get out of it. So what I did is I went home and I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not going to tell you the dictionary works, and I understood everything because I didn't. I got two things out of it. The first thing that I got out of it is that, hey, you know, I'm one of these people that are constitutionally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Because I thought that too high of a price to pay. And I had just lied to get this guy previously because I told him I was willing to go to any race to stay sober. But I thought this might be too high of a price to pay. And the other thing was, is some of us are so situated that we will never get married again, and that scared me. Because, you know, I don't want to be alone all my life. And that was the two things that I got out of that very first time I read the book. I went back there, and the next week I went back and I shared it with him, and he says, and I told him that I was done. He says, okay, we'll take the first three steps. So he took me back to this back room, this dingy ass around the club, and you know, your carpet is really clean compared to what this one was. And he says, we're going to take the first three steps here, and he says, the third one you're going to take on your knees. And I said, no problem. You know, I said, you know, I'll do what you want me to do. I don't ever want to go back out there and feel the way that I was feeling. And so we took 5 minutes first to take the first three steps. It took that long. He asked me three questions concerning them three steps, and we were done with it, and then we said the prayer of the third step in the book. And as soon as I'd gotten up off my knees, he says, okay, sit in that chair now and show you how to do the fourth step. And what he did was he outlined me on the fourth step the way it's outlined in the big book, with the resentments list, the fears list, and the sexuality list. And he says, I want you to do it this way. He says, these are the specific guidelines that this book gives us to inventory our lifestyle. And he says, if you do it any other way, I don't want to see it. This is the way that it should be done. He says, I don't know how to do it any other way. He says, this works, so do it this way. And so he outlined me on the fourth step and showed me how to do it. And he says, I gave you 3 days to do this. He says, but, you know, go home and start right now. So I went home right after he showed me how to do the fourth step. And I sat down, and I think I wrote until... I didn't stop writing until I was finished, is what I did. I didn't eat, I didn't drink, I cried a lot. Chucked my big book around the house a lot, you know. And I was flipping that thing around, you know. And I finished that fourth step. And so I went back to him the next day or a couple days later, and he was out of town. And I think it was right around Matthew Braff. Is when it was, and that's an AA convention up there. It's a camp out type thing, but he was out of town and his sponsor was there, and so I'd gone to his sponsor, and his sponsor was named Rich, and this guy would ask from the word go. You know, I never liked him at all, but I knew he knew a lot about the big book and stuff, and so I went and talked to him and I shared a little bit of this stuff with him, and you know, the guy told me to go get drunk, and all it did was give me more stuff for my inventory. It was like immediately talking to him. Well, I had absolutely no idea where to go. And so what I did is I went home and I opened the big book up and went back to where I had finished off at, and I flipped the page and I got the other questions that I needed, which was where I was at fault. And, you know, that's the most valuable part of the whole thing, you know. And then I understood why Dave told me that we don't care what you've done in your life. You know, what we care about is the repetitions of the things you have done that is going to give us what the book says, causes and conditions. You know, the things that kept, the self-centeredness is in my life that kept setting me up for the hurt that I was getting, which in turn led to the drunkenness that I was doing. And so what I did is I did that rest of that fire. I went back and shared this stuff with this guy. As soon as I got done with that, done doing the fifth step, what I did is I went down the fifth step with him, and he says, now what I want you to do is go home and take the hour out that it talks about in the book and review these first five proposals that you've just done. And he says, make sure you didn't leave nothing out, man, because if you left something out, it's going to get you later on. And he says, and after you do that, I want you to take the sixth step, which is just, am I willing to allow God to take these things from me? And if I'm not willing, then pray for the willingness to be willing. And so, and then he said, take the seventh step prayer, you know, and do that. And he says, when you're done with that, you got the eighth step, which is this list that we have just gone over with, and you pray to be willing to make these amends to these people. And this is the same afternoon that I had done my fifth step. You know, this is all in a week's period of time. And I says, okay. And so what I did is I was walking away from him, and he says, one more thing, Kenny. He says, what I want you to do when you get done doing that sixth and seventh and eighth step, he says, I want you to take the biggest and the baddest amends on that list and make it today. Not tomorrow, today. And Something I didn't share with you a little bit earlier is that I joined the Navy and I had a 6-year commitment with them, and when I moved to Alaska I went AWOL. And at the time that I'd gotten sober, I was 3 years AWOL. And that was the biggest and the baddest amendment I managed to make, because I knew I'd be something about this rigorous honesty stuff is I had absolutely no idea what this consists of. I said, I don't know how to be rigorous and honest, Dave. And he said, Kenny, he says, I'll give you something to go by. And he says, don't tell these people anymore and they need to know, but if they ask the question, you answer them honestly. And so that's what I did. So I went home and I'd taken that 6th from 8th step and prayed for fearlessness, prayed for rigorous honesty, got my truck, went over to Ellendorf Air Force Base, which is a base up there in Anchorage, went over to the Navy recruiter's office. But at the time, well, I had fairly long hair, it was down past my ears a little bit. That's long hair for me today because it's going back fast and it's going up fast. And I had a beard down my belly button. I'm still suffering from malnutrition because I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. I was only in this AA meeting a week before I started getting solutions. I looked like hell, felt like hell. My eyes were all caved in, and I was just sad looking. And I went into this recruiter's office, and I walked in there, and I told him my name, and I told him what I was doing, that I was trying to recover from that drug and alcohol addiction, and that I had been gone a long time. That's the exact words I told him. I said, I've been gone a long time. He says, wait a minute. He says, what are you talking about? And I says, well, yeah, I got a commitment with you guys for a 6-year term, and I took off 3 years ago, and I haven't been back since. And he says, Kenny, he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. And I said, I know it. And he says, I can send you Leavenworth right now for this. And I says, I know it. And I says, if you want to send me to Leavenworth and you feel that's what I got to do to fulfill my commitment with you people, I'll go to Leavenworth right now. He says, I can send you back to active duty. And I says, I'll go back to active duty. I says, I'll do anything to not ever drink and use drugs again. I'll do anything. Whatever you want to do with me is fine with me. You know something, I have to make you understand, this is not me talking. I'm a chicken shit, you know, I'm a guy. This is not me talking. I don't know where these words are coming from, but it is not me talking. And this guy, you know, he gives me this weird-ass look, goes to this file cabinet, and this is where I've done AWOL from, was Anchorage, and pulls out my file folder, and, you know, and I told you I'd excelled in the beginning because I wasn't drinking. So I had done good while I was there. And he looks at this folder, and at the time I had a 4-0, which is a good score as far as they're concerned. You know, deportment and everything like that. And he said, you had a good record up until the time you left. He says, what happened? I said, you know something? I don't know. I just checked out. I didn't want to play no more. He says, you know something? He says, I've been a recruiter for 25 years. He says, I have never encountered something like this before. He says, you sound like you're sincere in what you're doing, and you know something? He says, I'm going to give you a chance. He says, now get this. I had a 6-year commitment with these people. I'd taken off at 2.5 years. I was gone 3 years. I had 6 months left of my commitment with the United States Navy. I am AWOL. I have been gone a long time. You know, they don't shine on that stuff. This guy says to me, he says, I will give you a chance. He says, you got 6 months left of your commitment with the United States Navy. He says, if you finish that 6 months out without getting into any trouble whatsoever and not having no problems with us, he says, I'll give you an honorable discharge. You know something, folks? I got an honorable discharge from the United States Navy 6 months later. You want to talk about getting high on drugs and alcohol? Whoa. This stuff impresses me. And you know something? That was the very first amends that I had made. And when I walked out of that guy's office, I was higher than I had ever been on anything that I had ever taken, and I had done it all. You know, you name it, and I'd do it. And I floated out of this guy's office. And it was the first time in my entire life that I had ever felt the presence of God in my life. When I had taken the third step, I never felt the presence of God. You know, when I had taken the fourth step, I never felt the presence of God. When I had done the other three, I was just going through the motions. But when I walked out of this guy's office and made that amends, I had felt the presence. And it was powerful. And it was something that I was not sure of. It was something that was, you know, Greek to me, I guess. But anyway, I had made that amends, you know, and then and I went back and shared it with Dave and Stephanie. He says, okay, he says, now don't let up. And so what I did is I started making more amends. And it's funny how they fall into place. You know, if I have one step out of all 12 that I enjoy the most, it's 9. And believe me, it's not because I enjoy doing it, because I don't. You know, I told you I'm still real egotistical, and I got this personality that bolts at authority and humility and all that stuff. But I get the best results out of 9. So I'm willing to do what it takes to get the results from it. And I have had some impressive amends. You know, one of the things was is that when I was in high school, my family alienated me. My youngest brother was the last one to go, and my mom, when I was in high school, how she used to wake me up to go to school was with a broom from the door. That was how much. That was just how crazy I was. She didn't know how I was going to respond when she'd wake me up in the morning. So she just stuck the broom in the door and poked me and shut the door. And God bless her, I love her, you know. 2.5 years later, she's still doing it from the door. As a mom, you don't have to do that no more. But that was my mom, you know. She was real afraid of me. And this youngest brother, I tried to shove Alcoholics Anonymous down his throat. This does not work, folks. If somebody does not want what we have to offer, there's nothing you can do to give it to them. As a matter of fact, you might drive them away from it forever. Tough lessons to learn. I tried to shove it down my youngest brother's throat, and he disowned me. You know, he wouldn't talk to me for 2.5 years of my first 2 years of sobriety, or my first 3 years of sobriety. And finally, when I had let go of them completely, I thought, you know something, I love my youngest brother enough to allow him to die out there in them bars. If that's what he's got to do, you know something, he's my brother and I love him. So if he's got to do this, then I can accept this. And you know, I never even said this verbally. I had just said it to myself and to my higher power. And I'll tell you something, within 2 or 3 months after that, my youngest brother quit drinking. Now, I'm not going to tell you he did it in Alcoholics Anonymous. He did it on his own. But the reason why he had done it is that he was seeing the results that was happening to me in my life as a result of doing this stuff, and what was happening to my other brother, which went back to the Catholic Church, and it worked for him. You know, he's still there, and he's still sober. And my youngest brother quit drinking. And you know something? He's the one who wanted to drive 500 miles today to come over and hear me speak for one afternoon. You know, and when me and my brothers get together now, we love each other and we hug and we hang on to each other and we do things together, and it was not the way we were when we grew up. We hang with each other and we fought constantly. And it's not that way. In these amends that I was making in this fan time, you know, I was going to these Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and there was these people there, and you know something, one of them was Victor, and you can look at us, you know, he's nothing like what I am like, you know, and he's been in the meeting for a long time here now, so you know what his personality's like. And I love him, he's my best friend in the whole world. This guy went through the first year of sobriety with me, and we did some wild stuff, you know, something. There was 13 or 14 of us that hung around together at the time, and there was men and women both. And pretty much all of us were newcomers, and, you know, we did some wild things, like we'd get together certain nights, and when it was over, Victor had a full collection of movies that we'd go, and we'd go buy a couple gallons of ice cream, and then we'd get every pillow in his house, and the blankets, you know, and we'd all huddle together and eat buckets of ice cream, and watch old movies, you know, and that's how we stayed together when we were sober. And then there was 5 or 6 of us guys that hung out together quite a bit, and one of these nights that we were doing this, we seen this movie, you know, and I think there's a couple, you know, you call it the Old Mothers. And you know, there's a couple of you guys that qualify here, I guess, now, and that's good, I'm glad you're here. But if you don't know how we got that name is, because we were watching this old movie one night on television, and there's this movie, it's called Boys in Company C. And it's a war movie, and what it was is about these guys who played soccer. And they were rebellious, and they were cantankerous, and they fought the rules, and they did all of these things. But one thing that they did was they hung together, and they believed in what they were doing, and they got good at it. And so, you know, there was about 6 of us right here at the time, five or six of us guys that we were making, so we you know, we wanted to do what Alcoholics Anonymous suggested for us to do, and we were doing it. And so we started calling ourselves Old Mothers, you know, and I'd be forever grateful to Victor and TJ and Jimmy B and Slip and Scott. You know, these guys are invaluable assets to my life today. I think about them all the time, you know, and I just hope that they're all sober. I know that TJ is still sober, and I know Jimmy B is. And I think Scott has gone back out, and I don't know about Slip. I mean, the reason why we call him Slip is because the guy kept slipping. Well, I just hope he's sober. You know, I haven't had no contact with him. They're pretty much a victor. But, you know, we did wild things. We did everything everybody told us not to do that wasn't coming out of the book. You know, the relationship stuff, the chasing the newcomer rules. We did that. I still do it. I don't know if he does, but I still do it. You know, because when it was explained to me, my sponsor told me, he said, Kenny says, Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to rebuild and reestablish new relationships in your life. To establish new relationships in your life and rebuild old relationships. And he says, if you don't participate in them, you don't learn. He says, any relationship that comes down the pipe, I don't care if it's man or woman, you jump in with both feet. I said, yeah, but he says, no. He says, either you'll drink or you'll take the steps. It's as simple as that. You know, keep it simple, man. And so what I do is I participate with whoever comes along. I get a lot of opportunities to practice the principles because I haven't drank yet, so I take a lot of steps. But I met some fabulous people. There was this gal named Christy that we hung out with. This girl was a stripper down in one of the strip bars down in Anchorage. And she was wild, man. And you know something? She was wild. How she showed affection, she'd come up and punch it. Like, that's again, right? I mean, she'd come up and try to kick her ass. And the transformation that went on with this girl was unbelievable. You know something? She's a little Christian right now. She's got a family, got a couple kids, she's got a husband, she's successful. She got involved with some little church up there, and it's completely different. She sent me a picture here a couple of years ago of her, and I hardly even recognized her. And you know something? I got to experience that with her. And it was me and Victor the 12th stepper, you know, and she was a newcomer, and we were 90 days sober out there, you know. But you know something? We kept our motor straight. As possible, straight as possible. Well, I didn't say they were completely straight because I still think the way I thought when I thought I was doomed. I just don't act on it. And we 12 step there, and you know something? She got it and we kept it. You know, I still do it. I'm a redneck now. I come from Montana and I'm in Southern California right now, living and working. And the people that I get to sponsor and practice these principles are not the people that I would choose to do it with. But you know something? I couldn't have done a better job in picking him. You know? My God picked Victor Kozak to be my best friend and me being sober. And you know something? This guy pissed me off constantly. I'll share something with you about the isolation. You know, it talks about incomprehensible demoralization in the book. And that's something most of us got if we get here and we're ready. And I had it, you know, and one of the things about that demoralization that was the worst for me was that bone-crunching loneliness that a lot of us get when we get here, you know. It was just tremendous. And it was Thanksgiving, and it was swooping on me, and what I did is I locked myself down in my apartment. And I wouldn't come out. And he camped outside my door for them 3 days trying to get me to come out of that apartment. You know something? I know his story, and I know that isn't him. Because he's just like me, he don't care about people. But he was out there that whole time, and I knew it. You know something? Finally, he got me to come out. And I don't come out gracefully, you know. I told him to come in and say, shut up. I didn't want to hear what he had to say. But he did it, and he stayed there, and you know something? Another thing that he had done for me is he lied to me when we were newly sober. He had told me this cock and bull stuff about getting a running buddy. Late at night, one night at this midnight meeting, I hear you guys are having trouble with the midnight meetings around here lately. They were, you know, indispensable for my recovery because I was nuts. You know, I was acting just like probably what you got going on around here. But I was a late night bar drinker, so that's where I hung out was late at night. And I just hope you get your problems ironed out up here with that. God will take care of it, you know. You get it to him, he'll take care of it. But anyway, we were hanging outside this morning, and he lied to me and told me, you know, you got to get this. Or he didn't tell me at the time he was lying. He told me, you got to get a running buddy and somebody to hang out with, somebody who's concerned about taking these steps and following this stuff AA talks about. And I said, well, you know, he's 6 months ahead of me in sobriety. And I said, that sounds good. You know, I said, you want to be my running buddy? And he said, sure, sir, I'll do that for you. We know he's moving out, you know. And, so we started running together, you know, something. And a little bit after that, I'm stone cold sober, rolled my truck for the first time. First time I'd ever rolled a vehicle in my life, I'm stone cold sober, rolled my truck and totaled it. So that whole winter I had to depend on Victor and coming to get me. And a couple of months after he had told me this thing about this running buddy stuff, we were getting results of it. We were not only staying sober, but we were getting newcomers, newcomers in our life to hang out with us, and so we could pass the message on to them. And that was the thing my sponsor told me the very last time. He said, Kenny, give away what you received. And so what we were doing was hanging out together, and we were chasing these people and doing wild things, you know, and getting high off of it every single day. We were learning something new about rigorous honesty and sober and trustfulness and willingness and caring and sharing. And brought to me a couple months later and made a mention. He said, you know something, that stuff that I told you about getting a running buddy, it was all cock and bull. He says, I made that up. We'll do it, it's working, so let's not fix it. We've been running buddies ever since. Something that happened right after it was about a year or so, right in that area, the economy took a dive in Anchorage, and I mean, it was bad news. And I'm sober, and he's sober, and these other guys, and it was so bad that none of us could find work. And what happened is, the straw that broke my back is that we ended up in the food line at the Salvation Army. Yeah, I'd never had to depend on anything like that or anybody in my whole life. And here I am, stone cold sober, I found myself in the food line down to Salvation Army. And, you know, that's humiliating to me. That's not humbling, it's humiliating. Because I'm self-sufficient. Always had been, pretty much so. But, you know, I'd said enough. And so what I did is I left Alaska. And he was out in the gold mine. You've heard his gold mine story. He was on the gold mine at the time, and just before he left to go out there, he said, son of a bitch, he said, don't you leave before I get back. Well, right after he left, I hauled. And, you know, I had just enough money to get out of Alaska. And I ended up in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And this is some of the stuff that is the gift, you know. This is what it's like now for me. It's a gift that I get as a result of being a member of this fellowship. And so I went down to Jacksonville, Wyoming, and it was the first time that I'd ever been away from my home group. And I come home from work one afternoon, and I'm talking to these people. I'm living with five other people. I had never lived with anybody besides my family and this girl and my other brother my whole life. And I'm living with five other members of AA. Now that can get on your nerves. But I'm living with these guys. I come home from work one afternoon, and I say to them, you know something, you guys? I'm really alone, you know. I feel really alone. I miss my friends in Alaska, I says. I hurt really bad because of this, you know. And they said, well, Kenny, you got to establish new intimacies with us. And I said, hey, I understand this part of the thing. I said, I just want to let you know that I feel alone. And they would have them down the lake because nobody likes to hear somebody sniveling around here, you know. Except ourselves. I love to do it, you know. It feels good. So you can get somebody to listen. But anyway, I told these guys this, you know, and it was getting me, you know, and I didn't know what I was going to do, and this is the way the power in my life works today. And I hear it, and I see it, and I understand it. I understand my God today. I didn't understand him prior to getting here, but I understand him today. Is that I'm talking to these things, and I went upstairs, and I talked to him, and I said, God, you got to do something to help me deal with this loneliness. I said, I'll do whatever it takes. You know, and so what I did, I got up, and I went to the very next day, up and I went to work. I got off work and I started driving back, and it was an hour in between where I worked and home, and the loneliness started coming back on me again. I thought, you know something, I better stop and go to a meeting. So what I did is I stopped and I went to this meeting, and it was down in this little cubby hole, this dungeon kind of place. And I went down the stairs and I walked in the door and I looked down over the left, and there was a guy from Anchorage that I had got sober sitting there. This was Michael Stanton, you know. This was one of the other guys that was an old mother. He was the sixth one. And Michael was sitting there. And this is the next day after I'd told these people these things. And I said, Michael, I said, what are you doing here, man? Now get this. I never knew where I was going when I left Anchorage. I had no idea. I ended up in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Okay?
I go, what are you doing here, man? And he says, he was a helicopter pilot. He says, the Forest Service down here needs some help with their forest fires this summer. They sent me down here for the whole summer. The boys stayed the whole day in front of that. I was so stoked. And it was what I needed, you know, it was what I needed. And I thought, you know something, what are the odds? And this guy landing in the same meeting as me, 2,500 miles away from our home group. I said, what are the odds, you know? Same time. He never knew where I was, I never knew where he was. You know, it just trips me out. And then a couple of weeks after that, Victor shows up. I never knew he was leaving Alaska. He just showed up. How did you find out I was there? Anyway, he showed up and jacking home right with me. Well, I'm on one of these very nice escapades. The one thing I always loved was road trips. Still do a bunch of them. I just don't drink, you know. I just don't register the miles on how many beers I can drink. But if Victor shows up, you know, something. And, I hope you have heard a lot of the amends that he made, because his are impressive. You know, the amends that this kid made are impressive. Especially the ones in the state of California. You know, I truly believe God really does work miracles in our life if we're willing to go to any length to stay sober. And he stopped in and he saw me and he told me about the things that he was going to do on the East Coast and stuff. And went and done that and come back and lived with me for a while. And then came to California. And you know something, after he had come here to California, I followed him out here to see this other brother of mine that lives here. I had no intentions of staying here. I just wanted to come and thank him on teaching me how to pray. Because he was the one that taught me how to pray after I'd gotten sober. And so I stopped here in San Jose, and the very first meeting I'd gone to in California was Saturday Night Live. And I was impressed with it. You know something, Anchorage, there's a lot of men up there, and there's a few women, but California has got some good-looking women, I am telling you. It's going to be tough to probably be out of these meetings to go back to them meetings, but there's only 10 or 12 people, and 9 of them are old. You know, I just love the view down here, and I come to Saturday Night Live of all places. And I can understand why he made this place his home group, because this is a nice place. That's for you girls, because, well, I love you. I love every single one of you. I just wish I could hang with all of you. But anyway, I come Saturday Night Live, and I spent 2 months here when I went down to Southern California and spent some time in Los Angeles. Ran into another guy, you know, I'm down there whacking out again, you know, and I'm starting to get lonely again, and I'm working in a place called Simi Valley, and I remember there was another guy that I'd gotten sober with. He wasn't one of the old metals, but he was a guy that I'd gotten sober with and hung out with her quite a bit at the time. And I knew he'd moved to California, and at the time I was living in Lompoc, and I never knew where he was. And so what I did is I called back to Alaska and I had asked how many of them I could move. And I'd been in Simi Valley about 6 months at the time, and finally I'd gotten off my dead butt and called up there and found out where this kid had lived. We got this telephone number and called him up on the phone one day after work, and I was talking to him a little bit, and I said, well, where do you live, man? I said, you know, I'm down in this LA area. I said, I can drive and come and see you. And he says, well, I live in Simi Valley. This guy wasn't 3 miles away from where I was working. You know, and this is another person I got sober with in Alaska. And these things happen to me all the time. You know, they happen to me all the time. About the second or third meeting I walked into down in San Diego, I walked into this meeting and this kid was sitting across the room from me, and this is about 2 years after I had left Wyoming. There's this kid sitting across from me, and he looks at me and he says, do I know you from someplace? And I said, I don't know, I've been around a little bit. I just come from up around L.A. in that area. And he says, no, he says, I've never been up there. I says, well, where are you from? And he says, well, I'm from Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I said, no shit. And he says, what's your name? And I said, Kenny. And he says, you're that guy that says, there's no one got mad at Red Dead Paradise. And I said, well, you picked up from up there. His own sponsors used to say that stuff all the time. You know, and I used to say it a lot too. I didn't say it quite as much as I used to, but he says, you're that guy that says that, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I am. You know, and that was about the second or third meeting I walked into down there. You know, something Rick is still around down there. And I got to go to his first AA meeting, you know, and if I hadn't showed up here and participated in this stuff, I'd miss these moments. You know, I'd still be sitting on a bar stool someplace, hopefully sitting on a bar stool someplace, wishing I could experience life the way that I'm experiencing it today. I live in San Diego right now, you know, out in Bitchin' City down there. They got some great AA. You know, my home group, and get this, is mostly men. Very few, maybe one or two women come there a week. They trips me out every time I go, you know. The fellowship down there is tremendous. You know, World Convention is going to be, what, 2 years, year and a half. I don't know. I want you guys to all come down and share it with us. That was something that, you know, I got to spend. Jim Majors back there, him and his wife Barbara, you know, I met these guys up here at Saturday Night Live and got to spend some time with them up at the World Convention in Seattle in 90, and Perry, you know, I met Perry up there, and Kenny, he's another guy that hangs out in this group, and a few, and Perry, the other Perry. And you know something, I'll never forget these moments, because that thing, in the World Convention in 90 and in Seattle was so tremendous, and I'll say this and then I'll finish, is that it was a 7-day event for us, and me and Victor had gotten there a little earlier, and as a matter of fact, we stopped in Eugene, Oregon, and went to a convention on the way up there. You know, it was a good time in Eugene. I like that place. So welcome here, you know, glad to have you. But that event up there in Seattle was incredible. And by the third day, I was shot. I can't remember anything else that happened after that except the big meeting on Friday. I was totally emotionally bankrupt. I was gone. I don't even remember what we did. And he was asking me about some of the things we'd done, and it was such a high that it just cooked me. You know, I was cooked by the third day. You know, but I remember we started this thing up there as a, you know, the first couple of days everybody was real leery of each other, I guess, or just knew Seattle or whatever it was, and nobody was talking to anybody, and that's not normal for our fellowship. So what we did is we got right in front of the front doors in the registration office, and every single person that walked by us, we got right in their faces and introduced ourselves. And the reason why we did is because that was what we would start to do. And you know something? I met some pretty incredible people. We got to run around with these guys from Ireland that scared the shit out of me. Well, they were driving, you know. We got to meet these guys from Australia. They told me I can come down and hang out with them anytime. Met them in Eugene. Then ran into them again in Seattle. So you know something? You'll surely meet a few of us on the path if you stay on the path. And I'll make the newcomers, the two newcomers that introduce yourselves, a promise today. If you do exactly what that book says, you know, exactly the way it says, I'll make you a guarantee you'll never drink again. But if you change it to any way you think I'll be done, the deal's off. You know? Thanks for having me up here today, and don't go away, you won't have to come back. Thank you.